lovely to be back, and it's particularly lovely to be here to introduce Adrian Martin and Cristina Alvarez Lopez presenting their videos. And this has been a project of mine, an aim of mine, ever since I met Cristina and Adrian at the Goethe Institute in Frankfurt a couple of years ago. I was trying to think of ways to get them over, and luckily we've managed to combine various things, and here they are. So I'm going to say just a few words of introduction, more about them. First of all, I want to say that this session this afternoon runs from 1 till 3, not, as sometimes advertised, a considerably longer length of time. So we're here for 2 hours. And the session is chaired by Catherine Grant, who I'll introduce in a moment as well. Catherine is going to introduce the actual session, and I'm just going to say something about the people involved. And I particularly want to introduce Adrian Martin and say a couple of words about why I think his career in film and the work that he's been doing is so particularly important and particularly significant for us all, more wider than this particular session. Quickly to give some background, he studied film at Monash in Australia, where he's from, where he subsequently taught, and then he went I think 13 to 15 to the Goethe University in Frankfurt, which is where we met, and he's now based in Vilassar de Mar, outside Barcelona, where he's continuing his work, as I'll make clear in a moment. Now, the main point I want to make about Adrian Martin's work is that, to my mind, he's in the forefront of a new kind of film scholarship. In the first instance, this is a rediscovery of cinephilia, a redirecting of cinephilia. In the second instance, it's making use of all, to use Catherine Grant's term, the affordances that have come to us from new digital technology. And these two things, I think, are very key. In 2003, he collaborated with Jonathan Rosenbaum on a book called Movie Mutations, The Changing Face of World Cinephilia, which was a landmark, in a sense, as it included essays by what I think of as a much younger generation of film scholars, but who were, by that time, also quite established as important critics, curators, archivists, including Nicole Brenez and Alexander Hovar. So that was a kind of statement moment. Is that right, Adrian? He's nodding. and I think marked this new consciousness of cinephilia that's been developing since. Also just say that book had a postscript by the kind of venerable, aged, not so aged, really, pioneer of cinephilia, Raymond Belour, whose work in the 1960s had gone on being important and influential. But now, the expansion of the new forms of work with the affordances of digital technology. Here today, we'll see the video essays that he's made with Cristina Alvarez Cruz, so I'm not going to say anything about that kind of work. I want to mention two sides of Adrian's very, very multiple forms of public engagement. First of all is the extraordinary DVD commentaries that he's made over the years with the Australian company, outfit, whatever, Madman Entertainment. And it's a fantastic list which shows his work both with Hollywood of the studio system era and also a very kind of selected movies of really kind of early European art cinema. But this is just by and large, very generally. But it's an extraordinary list, and I'm going to make every effort to get hold of some of these. Secondly, and I think probably just as important and more public, is the work that he's done with online film journals, starting with Rouge, founded in 2003, and carrying on to Lola, and everybody here will be able to pick up the resonances of those names, so I won't necessarily go into them now. And if you can't, then you can figure it out. I think the last thing I would say is he works very widely journalistically. But I think also it's interesting to see Adrian coming out, working now, as it were, worldwide, living in Spain, but also in some sense a tribute, I don't know if he agrees with this, to the very lively film culture in Australia that really produced you and your approach to cinema. He's nodding again. Now, his work recently has been very much energized by collaboration with Cristina Alvarez-Cruz, who is a film critic, maker of video essays, who co-founded a Spanish online film magazine, Transit, in 2008. And they now work together producing these extraordinary insights into, I won't even say, film of all kinds, and you'll see the variety and the way in which criticism, cinephilia, film analysis can come together literally, visually, in front of one's eyes. I'll just hardly introduce Catherine Grant, because she does so much work with us now at BME. One could almost use the cliche, she needs no introduction. And also because she's been such a very key person in this particular field. She's a senior lecturer in film studies at Sussex, but her most important contributions are founding Film Studies for Free in 2008, which was an extraordinary pioneering use of online and possibilities of online, and developed her own work as a video essayist, which is extremely remarkable and worth looking at online. But out of her own creative work, her interest in the possibilities of online publishing possibilities, she then founded In Transition in 2014, which I think is the first ever peer-reviewed journal of the video essay. And the important thing about In Transition is not only does it publish video essays, but it also enables online interaction, so continuing the form into debate and discussion, which is one of the key aspects of the video essay and its engagement out of the private cinephilia into public debate and discussion. So, very glad to see them. Please welcome Christina, Adrian, and Katie.
Okay, well, thank you to Laura for the lovely introductions, and also to Laura and Bimi, Michael Temple, Matthew Barrington here today for their hosting of this wonderful event and this wonderful possibility, which I'm delighted by and honoured by, to take up yet another conversation with Adrian and Christina about their work. A little bit first about the structure of today, do a brief introduction, a few preliminary remarks, and then we're going to go straight into some screenings. We're going to screen six videos of varying lengths by Adrian and Christina this afternoon, and each of those videos they will introduce, and then we'll have a discussion between us after each of them. And then at towards the end of the proceedings, but hopefully leaving plenty of time for this, we will have a possibility for audience questions and conversation as well. So that's how we'd like to do things. I wanted to begin by saying, as Laura has said, a lot of what I do in relation to audiovisual essay work online is curating, it's publishing, it's peer reviewing, it's assessing. In other words, I have to kind of be careful and remain neutral and be inclusive and all-encompassing in my interest in this field, which of course I am, but I do have favourites, and my favourite video essayists are definitely Adrian and Christina, and there are two reasons for that. One is in a way, the amount of their work. They keep making work regularly. There's always new essays coming online. They experiment with lots of different forms in those video essays. But they also write about them so well, because all of us involved in this field, we're not necessarily interested in audiovisual essays becoming a kind of standalone form that could replace and obliterate all other forms of film criticism, but we're interested in the way that these forms take up their place in a landscape that's also populated by writing. And so discourse about these forms and the understanding about them is partly verbal, and you have produced some of the most insightful and important pieces of writing about audiovisual essays as well. And I kind of wanted to start, before I ask you to introduce the first video, just by, in a way, asking a question about one of your standpoints in that work. You wrote a brilliant piece which was based on a lecture that... Actually, it wasn't. This was a piece that I think you published... at Nexus, perhaps, possibly. It was the very first introduction that you wrote when you started a regular, the regular work of curating essays for Nexus, the European Journal of Media Studies online. And in the very first introduction to that work, you titled it A Child of Two Mothers, the audiovisual essay is A Child of Two Mothers. And I just wanted you to possibly say what you meant by that, as it's an interesting introduction to the field.
Okay, I'll jump in. And yeah, that title, and in fact, in the piece itself, we say that the audiovisual essay is the child of at least two mothers. But the two that we were specifically thinking of there is that, in the sort of broadest possible sense, you know, we see the audiovisual essay as a form of film criticism, film analysis. On the one hand, it sort of comes from teaching, from various forms of writing about film. It comes from a certain, what's often called an explanatory or a pedagogic mode. So there's that sort of tradition that feeds into the audiovisual essay. But then, just as importantly, on the other side, there's experimental film, there's video art, there are all of the creative forms, particularly ones that have used found footage, that use material from pre-existing films, television shows, digital artworks, whatever. And part of the work that Christina and I do is to sort of be in a bit of a hybrid space between, you know, as it were, pure education and art, you know, creativity. And we try to mix those things in many ways.
That's great.
Well, just to add a little bit about this, I think that actually this is also because we both think that criticism, because many times we are asked, especially with some pieces that we make, oh, but this is film criticism, or it's more towards the world of art. And I don't know, I think you agree with this, but for me, all the pieces that we do are film criticism, and what we have in mind is to do a piece which is doing an act of film criticism, but also our idea of film criticism is that it's an art, and it doesn't matter. I mean, you can do it in a written form, you can do it in an audiovisual form, but you are, I mean, of course, it's art in the sense you are creating something, and you are creating something in a specific medium. So I think that this is also why we bring, especially in our work, these two things together, because we see them that one takes from the other, and
yeah,
they are related.
Yeah, because both Christina and I very much sort of believe in the possibility of, you know, what we call creative criticism. As Christina says, whether it's written form or whether it's an audiovisual form or any other kind of form, you know, live performance form, there are many possible forms, but all of them should aspire to be creative in themselves.
And there was one more question I had about the sort of general matters before we begin with the specificity of your work, which is your preference for the term audiovisual essay, because as Laura kind of indicated in her introduction, there's lots of different words floating around for this, lots of different terms. Video essay, in transition, refers to videographic film studies, so as not to sort of fetishize the idea of the essay. But you use most frequently in your work the notion of the audiovisual essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because actually for us, sound is very important, and when we do video essays or audiovisual essays, we many times separate sound and image, and many times we are working a lot with sound. So, and because, I mean, you can say they are videos, of course, but they are digital, so they are files. Without audiovisual, it's actually more precise term, in the sense that if we are doing an essay, it's both with image, it's both with the visual, but also with the sound. And in our case, I would say we work a lot with sound. I mean, there's people that doesn't work much with sound, that basically, I mean, they, for instance, they never separate sound and image. When they are editing blocks of sound and image together. But we many times we don't do this. We separate audio and image. We work with sound a lot. So we thought that at least for our work, it's more precise, this term, which you could say that it's not for everybody. I mean, I can understand why some people call them video essays or visual essays, which I don't like at all, because, I mean, basically you are saying sound doesn't matter, but for us it matters, sound, so that's why we prefer this term.
And the essay part of audiovisual essay, for us, essay is, you know, is a very open term. It means many things. It means attempting something, you know, to essay something. It means to experiment with something. But it also has the connotations, the more conventional connotations of an essay, of an argument, of a proposition. And we try to work with all of the different meanings of that word.
Now we've cleared all of that up. Thank you very much. Let's move on to your introduction of your first video that you're going to
show.
Okay.
So the first piece we're going to show today, this is in fact a world premiere you're getting. It's one of our very latest pieces. It was commissioned by the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, ACME, in Melbourne. Of course, it should be the Australian Centre for the Moving Image and Sound. But moving image, my God. So it's an ACME commission, and it goes with a retrospective that they're going to screen in November, which is a retrospective of Roman Polanski's films, 10 Roman Polanski films. And so we were asked to do an audiovisual essay that we've done on a number of occasions, which is a director study. And in this case, we ended up using 8 of the 10 films that are going to be screened in the Polanski retrospective in Melbourne, from his first feature through to one of the most recent features of Polanski. And you'll recognise the classics as they come up. Now, I just want to say before we watch this one that particularly when we do a director study, but in fact even when we analyse one film in an audiovisual essay, we aim for what we call a logic. We try to find a logic in that filmmaker's work. And what we mean by that is not simply to note recurring motifs or elements and not simply to say these are the favourite themes or concerns of this director. What we try to do is that we actually try to figure out a kind of a sequence, a proposition, a story. Like we try to tell a story of how one obsession of that director kind of logically leads to the next, and how the pieces, the recurring pieces or the recurring themes and variations in a director's work, how we can kind of structure an idea of how all of that works, what logic it forms. So our theme, as you'll very quickly see, because we put it in the title, is that we alighted on this idea of invasion, that Polanski's cinema is a cinema of invasion on many levels. Okay, let's go into it. Okay.
Okay, so it's wonderful to see that on the big screen, but it really works on the small screen as well. And watching it in preparation for today, I was thinking that it was the perfect video essay to show, the perfect audiovisual essay to show the possibilities of different kinds of montage. So we have both the kind of, in a way, the two basic units of grammar of the audiovisual essay as it's developing online are either a sequential montage where you have a kind of a comparison, sometimes through even morphing between images, but certainly by juxtaposing them in a line, a temporal line. Mm. But also the other basic unit of grammar, which is the multiple screen comparison, the side-by-side. And you use the two forms here. Actually, it's quite unusual to use two forms in one essay and in a really complex way. And on the one hand, that really shows the amazing advantages of this format as a presentational medium. So you're presenting an argument about the logic that you described for us at the beginning. But I also think that it must have advantages as a process of making as well. And given that both of you are film critics who, before you started making this kind of work, audiovisually, were writing about directors' logics, I wanted to see if you could say a few things about the advantages of doing this kind of work in an audiovisual form for you. Mm.
Well, because I'm very conscious of precisely what you're raising there, Katie, that, you know, it's easy. I mean, I myself have you know, written an essay or two on Polanski in my time. And, of course, it's the easiest thing in the world to simply write a paragraph where you say, you know, there are many doorways in Polanski's films. There are doorways in Cul-de-sac. There are doorways in Repulsion, and there are doorways in The Ghost Rider. And it's like, okay, you know, if I watch those films again, maybe I can prove this thesis, I can test this out. And often one is left with, you know, the expressive limits of written language, particularly in that kind of thing. When you're doing a list, when you're trying to compare a whole lot of films, whereas, you know, what's often said about the audiovisual essay is that whole idea of, okay, now we can actually quote the stuff, we can actually put the evidence right there, you know, we can show you three doorways in one go, either in a sequential montage or on screen at once. And I know with Christina working on this piece that we discovered much more in the films than we thought there was, like before we started editing them up. Do you want to say that?
Well, I mean, if you think, for instance, a piece like this, I think in order that you do something like this in writing and that it was valuable, I think it would be very long. Because I think one of the things that you work in audiovisual essays, it's a kind of condensation. You condense a lot in very few time. But here there are actually, around the idea of invasion, there are actually a lot of themes. We begin, for instance, talking about how invasion is expressed through the way he frames, through the way that he uses background and foreground in the same shot, through the way he puts the characters, through the mise-en-scene of the shot. But also, we talk a bit about narrative, how, for instance, we use a lot of Bitter Moon, which at the start it was a movie that we didn't know very well how we would use. But of course, this is also a movie of invasion in the sense it's about a romantic relationship that goes all wrong. But basically, the idea of this movie is that both characters, in fact, and this changes around as the movie develops, they feel invaded by, love, it's an invasion too. So there's actually a lot of themes around this idea of invasion, and that's what you were talking about before, how we try to develop the logic of a theme in a movie. So if we are going to talk about invasion, we're going to try to see in all the ways in which this theme is brought to the movie in very different ways. Some ways are more about style, about mise-en-scene. Some other things are more about narrative. Some other things are more about semantics, about the meaning. But here, it's very condensed. The ideas are very condensed, and actually, you can see them on screen very easily. But in a text, in order to develop this, and that it doesn't look simply like an enumeration, I think it would be really a very, very long text, considering all the movies that we are using, that it's 8 movies. So in a way, one of the things that an audiovisual essay allows you to do, I think, is to put a lot in a very small time and in a very small space, in a way. And we usually say that we like people watching them more than once, because actually it happens a lot, and it's very possible that you miss a lot of things in the first viewing. But this is one of the differences that I find, for instance, in working in audiovisual essays in comparison with writing a text. And about working with two screens, about working with sequential montage or putting two screens together. For instance, here there was a moment in which the double screen was very useful because we were already a bit long. We didn't have a limit of time, but we know that you cannot give something of 1 hour. People doesn't expect that. So, for instance, the part about the... we wanted to develop this part about... how this question of invasion, usually in men, in Polanski's films, it's all about this idea of masculinity. Many men begin to dress as women, begin to feel like their identity is like disintegrating in the sense that they are becoming women. while in women, usually it has to do with rape. But this, the way we were doing it, we thought that this was going to be very, very long. So we had this idea of, why don't we put together the two things, in one screen women, in the other screen men. And I think this, for instance, saved us a lot, because this could have been like 3-4 minutes more if we had done it in a sequential montage. So one of the things also that can give you the double screen, it's again this thing of condensing. Part that it's very useful to compare, but also sometimes in questions of rhythm and of time, you can do a lot also with the double screen.
And I think in that scene that you described, it's one of the most incredibly nimble and ethically okay examinations of those themes in Polanski, that act of actually bringing the thing that he's often criticized for with the other thing he's also doing at the same time, literally in the same frame, is a really original turn in this work. And as you said, one that could only really be discovered through working in this way. But this film does have a script. And was it a question of kind of writing a script and paring it down, or how did the script work for the voiceover?
Well, in this case, what we did, sometimes we have written the voiceover before. I mean, we have some ideas about what fragments do we want, how do we want the piece to evolve, but we write the voiceover before. In this case, we did like a kind of test. We write a bit of voiceover, but we recorded it a bit later because... Especially, I mean, we were conscious that we had like a lot of material and we were a bit afraid that it would be too long. So basically we sketched more or less the development of the piece. How the piece would develop. But later we began to edit and we began to do some tests with the voice, reading what we, and sometimes suppressing some things. Finally, at the end, when we had it almost finished, we had to change the order of a couple of things, and we had to record a little bit of extra text for one section. But this was one piece where these ideas were there, but we edited a bit in advance before recording the voiceover.
I think in general, Christina and I are moving more and more towards trying to keep the finished form as open as possible till the very end. And the problem with, like, we never write a conventional complete script for our audiovisual essays. We never have a script with the voiceover and the choice of images, right, or choice of clips. Sometimes, as Christina's saying, we start with a text. But this was a case that as you've just heard, we kind of tailored the text and improvised and tried it out and re-recorded it and rewrote it and re-edited it. After the image and sound editing.
I mean, the ideas of what it's in the text were there, but they were not yet written or formed. Mm. No, we knew we wanted to talk about the things that you've seen at the start, for instance, about the shots, about how he was using a background and foreground to put the characters. We knew we wanted this because we had like a series of shots. Because this happens in a lot of movies where you have like a couple relationship and there's like a third party that intrudes. But this is, apart that sometimes it's like the seat of the movies, it's shown visually in a very strong way. Usually you have the couple in one part of the shot and you have the third party entering in the shot. So more or less the ideas were there, but it was not properly written till we had... like a rough cut of the piece edited.
Mm. And, you know, as a general principle, Katie, I'd say that, you know, our objection to having a totally pre-written script is that you end up simply illustrating the sort of the idea you started with, which is different to what we try to do as an ideal, which is, in fact, to discover something, like for these films, for this material to surprise us. And, you know, sometimes it's simply just... putting two things together or quickly running through the material and we'll see, you know, my God, this is an incredible rhyme with this, or this is an echo of this. And that will lead us to further editing, you know, and further experimentation with it.
That's great. Okay, maybe we shall move on to the next audiovisual
essay. Well, the next piece we are going to show, it's very different from this one. It's a piece that is called A Season in Hell. And this is... Well, I'm going to explain you the idea, the first idea that we had for this piece, which was we realized that there was a very strong resemblance, or we thought there was a very strong resemblance between the actresses of the two movies that we are using, which is, one of the movies is In the City of Sylvia. It's a Spanish movie by José Luis Garín. And the other one, it's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Miss Osborne, which is a movie we know very well because we did an audiovisual essay on this movie. And we had like this, this happens to me a lot, which I see resemblances between people all the time, in movies even more. But we never had this idea of doing an audiovisual essay that departed from that, because it's like a very fleeting idea. How do you do an audiovisual essay on the resemblance of an actress to another actress? But we really wanted to do something with that. So we began to look at several scenes of the movie. Of course, it's not so much that the actresses resemble each other, but that in certain situations, and you know, it has all to do with the light, with the movement, with everything, there are some expressions that really resemble each other. So we wanted to bring this out, but at the same time, we knew that this was not enough to make a piece, you know, that could stand alone in itself. So we thought, how can we work with these two films, they are very different films in a way. But we thought, and this is something we've done other times, in this concept that we have, that it's from two different scenes to create a new scene, which we call an imaginary scene. And in this case, you will see how we've worked this question of the resemblance, but what we wanted to do, what we thought we could do, because it's an important thing in both the scenes that we are using of the two movies, is to work a bit with the idea of elastic time. So how can a moment in time at the same time transport you to another moment? How time it's like a completely elastic thing that grows and shrinks. And this was a bit like the idea of the idea that we end up in the audiovisual essay, but everything began with this resemblance of these two actresses that you will see now, and you will see how we've worked with that resemblance.
That one's wonderful. I think that one is definitely one that works even more amazingly on the big screen, and it feels like, therefore, kind of one that's very much in the art, at the art end of your work, the poetic end. You kind of talk in one of your written essays about the form, and Adrian alluded to this at the beginning, of the difference between the sort of instructional model, the pedagogical model of explanatory audiovisual essays, and then the cine-poetic end, which you describe as the sublime end. And it feels to me like that's the completely sort of abyssal, sublime end of what you're doing. And I think both of you had been quite experimental with your earlier written forms of film criticism as well. But in a way, there's a leap, isn't there, with this kind of work. It's publishing it in a film critical context, and this was published at
Fandor.
Oh, was it Fandor? Well, that's even more kind of amazing, really. You know, but that they at a certain point anyway, kind of open to publishing an experimental piece like this. But there's an ethical question in here I wanted to ask, which is around your willingness that you stated, Christina, with detaching audio, pressing that button on the video editing software, because here the audio you're using is kind of found audio, but it comes from other films. Do you want to talk a little bit about the decision behind that choice?
Well, in that case, I mean, of course, you start hearing it's a song which is actually from the movie, In the City of Sylvia, the one that they are dancing in the disco. But later, when we began to edit the moment of the two women merging, we didn't know what piece to use, but we didn't wanted to use any music that was from the movies, because we didn't wanted that this moment was too related with any of the two films. So we wanted something differently. And thinking a bit in the, the idea of using the music, the music that we use, it's from La Vie Nouvelle, from a movie that Philippe Grandrieu, and it came, I think, for the title a little bit, because, of course, in The City of Sylvia, it has to do a lot with La Vita Nuova, with Dante. Mm. So I think that it was a bit of a chance through the title, it came the idea of this piece. And we heard it and we thought it's great. It doesn't have lyrics. It's going to work very well for what we wanted. And we began to try, and it was absolutely fantastic. So that's my ethic. Mm. If it works, you use it.
But in a way, it's the ethic of the artist, not the ethic of the scholar, although it ought to be the ethic of the scholar, and hopefully we're making it the ethic of the scholar. But it's that willingness to, in a way, misrepresent something or to mess with the representation of something because of what you could achieve through doing that, which is, you know, it's a bold and courageous move, but the power of it is very apparent there. Now, I want to move on because we've got another couple of shorter videos, but and another long one to conclude with. So would you like to introduce the next
video? Okay. So the next one was also published on the website Fandor, the Fandor Keyframe section of Fandor, which Fandor's a movie streaming site, but they have a section for articles and for videos. And this is one we did where we took a chance on suggesting the choice of Jean-Luc Godard's film Masculine Feminine, which at that moment was being screened in a restored form at the Cannes Film Festival. So Fandor agreed for us to do it. And the piece we made about masculine feminine is called Queer Godard. And this piece is designed somewhat as a provocation. And it's based on something that I had noted maybe 10 years earlier when I did an audio commentary on masculine feminine for the company Madman that that Laura mentioned before. And as I was studying masculine feminine those years ago, I sort of noticed that there was this intriguing lesbian theme in the film of this lesbian intrigue between two women and how this relates to the men, and particularly the Jean-Pierre Léo character in the film. And when I started reading back through, you know, 50 years of criticism, of written criticism about masculine and feminine, this is almost never mentioned. It's never seen, or not never, but is often completely overlooked in the film, that there is this queer element in masculine and feminine. And some writers note it and then dismiss it. Some compare it to the original story by Guy de Maupassant. Anyway, so when we came to do this video, we went further into this. We studied the film more. We tried to find everything in the film that relates to this particular, as it were, unseen element of the film. We also went back and read closely the original Maupassant story. And we eventually came up with a form of sort of juxtaposing quotations from the original story, which was a sort of the source of inspiration for Godard, and then these particular moments and configurations in the film.
That's obviously a very powerful piece, and in a way there's no equivocation about the point of your argument in that, and the kind of use of mockery by the kind of abundance of audiovisual evidence for what earlier critics had called fleeting, and brilliant use of the text. One of the things that most interests me about this one, though, because it is a little bit different from many of your other video, your audiovisual essays, which is that it uses pastiche. And it clearly uses pastiche of Godard, I think, to great effect. And that's a strategy that lots of audiovisual essays by other people do. In a way, how can you not pastiche the film that you are using distilled extracts from? It's a question I think it often arises. But I also thought this was really interesting in relation to the online context of its publication, that this also parodies and pastiches to very successful effect, because I think it's a very much viewed essay of yours online. The listicle culture of a lot of online publishing. So, I mean, Godard uses lists and numbers and countdowns, but, you know, so does online culture. It's much easier to get readers or viewers of a piece if you say six reasons why Brad Pitt is hot or whatever. So, you know, so that your poor audience is not going to worry about, is this endless? Is this interminable? If I press play, am I ever going to be able to stop? And I love how your work uses that here. You talk a little bit about the role of pastiche in this particular one for you.
Well, I'll start on that. I mean, generally, you know, we do try to avoid pastiche because I think this, well, it's something, you know, I'd say it's something that neither of us actually much like or enjoy in a lot of audiovisual essay work, is that, you know, If it's an essay on Wes Anderson, you have to do it in a Wes Anderson style. If it's, you know, Kubrick, you've got to do it in a Kubrick style, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And sometimes, which in order to get a perspective on the work, you have to not do that. You know, you have to, you know, create your own style, your own mood that is not, you know, the standard mood of the film or of that filmmaker. This time, in fact, we were, I'm trying to sort of remember what really led us there, but at a certain moment we did sort of grab a Godardian form, which was, and we used the gunshots, which of course are used in the original film, the numbers, and of course the film itself and some other Godard films often have this subtitle of, you know, 15 precise facts or something like that. So Godard's always been a playful sort of anarchist with lists and numbers. We at a certain point we sort of grabbed that. Did you remember?
I think it was when we decided that we were going to use the quotes of Maupassant.
Yeah.
And because the quotes come from totally different places of the story, we thought, well, in a way it would be good to have number sections,
yeah,
and to have a little bit this intro, like if it was a Godard movie. And the other thing that we wanted to take a bit of Godard, it was the idea of this sound, which is a bit unpleasant, yes, and a bit,
violent.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that this kind of this form is one of the other genres of the audiovisual essay, like a split-screen comparison is a genre, the sequential comparison is another genre, the voiceover-led piece is another genre, and then this list or chaptering of material seems to be kind of particularly prominent.
I mean, in general, I would say we're always trying to find some variations of form, you know, to find a different form. So, you know, at a certain point, we didn't do any voiceover ones. You know, we were actually sort of very against using voiceover. And partly because at a certain point we knew that, you know, to get our work published in certain online places, there was a kind of a demand, implicit or explicit, for voiceover, to make them more accessible or whatever. But then we thought, okay, let's try this, you know, and let's see what we can do with voiceover that makes it more a technique of ours.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's pure audiovisual montage, sometimes it's with voice, sometimes without. Queer Godard was an example where, you know, we didn't need a voiceover. We knew that we could express what we wanted with intertitles. So that was a case where it was intertidal language rather than the spoken language.
Mm. Which is some of us are kind of calling the epigraphic genre, where the kind of the text is allowed to sort of frame what either follows or sometimes even precedes it. I think you use that very effectively. Shall we move on to your next video, please?
Okay, the next one, it's Shapes of Rage, and this is... this you could say it's a comparative audiovisual essay between Hitchcock's The Birds and David Cronenberg's The Brood. But again, this was a piece that began, we were watching The Brood because we had to prepare a class on David Cronenberg, and we were watching the film and we realized that there were some scenes of attacks, some action scenes, which actually reminded us a lot to The Birds. And it was in the way these scenes develop, the narrative of the scenes, but also in very concrete stylistical choices, as some angles that he was using. So, again, we thought, why don't we put these movies together to see really how similar they are? That's how we began. When we put the films together to see how similar they were, we, of course, and that's what you were talking yesterday also, how sometimes you learn a lot in the process of doing audiovisual essays. It's not that you do the audiovisual essay as... I think I don't know if for everybody, but for me it's a great difference between doing audiovisual essays and writing texts. Is that actually I have the sense that in the process I learn much more doing audiovisual essays than writing texts. Writing texts for me, it's more... I mean, you got the idea, and in a way you develop the idea in your head, but you don't necessarily need to write to develop the idea so much. Well, with audiovisual essays, there's a lot of things that come while you are making them. And one thing we realized, for instance, in this case, it was that, of course, there were similarities in the style and in the narrative, but the thing that really put together these two movies, it was that they both were working, were trying to give a visible form to something that it's an emotion. So they were both trying to find a way, to invent a way to figure something which was not actually tangible or material or visible. How to put form, how to show in a movie something which is a feeling, an emotion, no? In this case, rage. And actually, there's like a lot of, I hope that you will see that in the audiovisual essay, a lot of similarities in the way the movies do that. Because, for instance, I mean, in both cases, you have something which is a multiplicity. It's not one figure. It's a group of figures. It's a group of birds. It's a group of this creature. I don't know if you have seen The Brute, but in The Brute, it's like a kind of strange creatures that are like little monsters. Then another thing that we realized while working with the movies, it was, of course, in both, it's very important, the figure of the mother, and both play with the idea that everything that happens in the movies arises from feelings, from emotions that come from the mother. And we thought it was also very interesting to put the figures of the mother together and see how both films treat the figures of the mother, which in this case is different because in Hitchcock's film, I would say that while the film is in the conscious level, the mother is still very much repressed. But in The Brute, for instance, the woman, which is actually seeing a psychiatrist and everything, she, in her conscious state, finally embraces all these feelings of rage that she's having. So in this sense, and especially at the ending of the audiovisual essay, you will see that we compare a lot, compare in the sense of, not because they are similar, but because there's a great contrast between these two figures. And, well, in a way, you will see that it's... The audiovisual essay, it's a bit, it develops a little bit like the movies. There are a lot of action scenes punctuated by very more explanatory parts where it's explained a bit of the plot and a bit of the motives. People is trying to understand why these attacks happen in one film and in the other. I think that's it.
Just a quick question comment on that, which is what comes out of a simple comparative juxtaposition. And there are many of those online, and often one thinks, well, yeah, and so what? It's like this, that's like this, they look the same. But in a way, this one really works, I think, in arguing the point of the comparison and the point, you know, with the punchline kind of last shot, but all the way through. And it's a kind of accretional argument, again, through abundance of evidence, but also through your presentation of it, around motherhood being the thing, not just a kind of visual similarity or a plot similarity or a kind of any old intertextuality, but about cinema's figuration of motherhood somehow.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think part of what sort of drives us with a piece like this is not simply to say this film is like this film or Cronenberg was influenced by Hitchcock, which may or may not be the case. Finally, that doesn't matter. For us, it's also the difference between the films. You know, it's not just the similarity, it's the difference, and different eras, different ways of handling all of these kind of themes. And these themes are both form and content. You know, it's not simply the figure of the mother or the story of the mother. It's also, as Christina was saying before, to find a cinematic form for rage and sort of energy. I mean, it's sort of one of our obsessions in a way is you know, what is cinematic energy and how does it sort of channel itself? And then how can you work with that as an audiovisual essayist?
Yeah, and also, I don't know, in this piece, for instance, I think, there's a lot actually that reveals not so much through similarity, but through when you put the movies together, it's like if one movie it's revealing you something about the other that maybe you hadn't realized. And in this case, for instance, in the last part, how is called the character in The Birds?
Melanie.
Melanie. Of course, when you put Melanie with that girl, you realize that at the end of the movie, she's really a girl. I mean, she's totally, she can do anything. She has been attacked so much by the birds. And actually, the last scene with the mother, it's like if she has become a girl again. She's not anymore the decisive woman that she is at the start. She's a girl. But this is also something that it reveals much with much force because you put it with the other movie together and because you are putting it with a girl. But it's not so much they look alike. It's more what one movie does to the other by putting them together, which I think it's interesting. and I think it affects, I mean, an audiovisual essay, you can get this also in a different way that you would in a text, because in a text, finally, it's you. I mean, it's always you, because of course there's a maker, no? But I would say that in an audiovisual essay, you have more the illusion that sometimes it's the movie itself that it's interacting with the other. It's like if there was no body behind it. Of course there is, you know, but it's there's more like this kind of illusion. While in a text, I think, you're always more conscious, whatever you do in a text, that there's somebody writing it, that whatever thing that happens between two films, it's because there's somebody there doing that action. While in an audiovisual essay, it looks more, and I say it's an illusion, but it looks more that it's the movies themselves that are doing this one to each other.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant comment. They're kind of like generative machines. And there is they definitely rely on automatism and techniques like that, where, you know, the technology is revealing something to you, to come back to Laura's use of affordances.
If I can just point out one particular detail of discovery for us when we made that, which was, you know, an incredible thing for us to realise, is that, you know, Hitchcock used sort of stylized, synthesized sounds of birds, right? And Cronenberg chose to stylize the sound of these, like, monstrous creatures, and they're the same sound. I mean, when we layered them, we can no longer tell which are the birds and which are the Cronenberg creatures. So we were able to do a whole kind of audio mix, which confuses even us. I mean, we don't even know.
In the part of the doors, when they are, like, breaking the doors, that's we thought, well, why don't we play? I mean, they are so similar, you know, that we can play and put the sound of the birds in the brute and the sound of the brute in the birds, and we did it, actually. And I would say I still distinguish them, you know, but they are really, really similar. Yeah, and sometimes, but this is true, that sometimes when you audiovisual essays, one of the things that happens is that you see them and you forget sometimes what you've done. I mean, you say, this sound was like this in the movie, or did I do it like that?
And, and that's obviously a question for the audience too. And it's one of the issues around the scholarly use of these things, because, you know, in a way, remembering what you did and being able to distinguish those kinds of gestures is pretty important in explaining this as a method. But it is sometimes quite difficult. I wondered if we might play the last two videos together, and if you could introduce them both now, and then that hopefully will open up some time. We'll have a little few comments afterwards, and then we'll open up for a discussion with the audience, if that's okay.
Okay. So should I begin? Okay, so the first one, I'm going to be very brief. The first one you are going to see now, it's a video which is called Death Drive, and this is the... This was going to be also a world premiere, but it's not, because because they published it last week. We were not expecting it would be so soon. But this is part of a new series of video essays that we are doing now for the Film Grant, and the series is called The Thinking Machine. And this first one, it's about Girl on a Motorcycle, a film by Jack Cardiff from 1968. And basically, this was also an idea that came to us, like, very naturally. We were watching the film, which I think we can say we don't think it's a masterpiece, though I think we like it more now that we've done the audiovisual essay, because one of the things that we were impressed with the film, it's that it had, like, a very systematic... I mean, this is a movie... It's a movie about a woman that has just got married, and all the movie it's his drive on motorcycle to meet with her lover. She has a lover, which is Alain Delon. Who wouldn't go to meet with Alain Delon even if you are married, no? Well, Marianne Faithfull does. So it's all her trip to meet with this man, and while she drives, she's remembering other encounters that she had with him. And what we found very interesting about the film is that it's super systematic in the way it constructs these two movements. One movement that it's a movement in a space, a movement towards that man, which is her drive, basically, and another movement which is like a movement of immersion, and that has to do all with memories, with the memories of her ecstatic encounters and the great sex that they had together and all this. And how the movie uses very specific cinematic tools to portray these two movements. No? In one case, it's like the camera moving with the character. In the other case, there's a lot of zoom-ins and zoom-outs, and also this sense of freeze time. So we worked on this because we thought it was like a very interesting theme and very cinematic and very... I mean, the film is based in a novel by André Pierre... I would never pronounce his name right. You can say it.
I think Katie's...
André Pierre de Mondialgue.
How beautiful. And the novel, it's very much the same thing, but of course it doesn't have the same sense. I mean, it's also a novel that it's all about her driving and her remembering, but the effect that this has in the movie, I think, I like the novel better, but I think that this precise conjunction of movements, of a movement in a space and a movement in memory, it's more powerful in the movie because it's very, very cinematic and because the movie has found their own tools to represent these two movements.
Okay, and then we're going to do a crash edit from Death Drive to our final audiovisual essay piece. And this is a fairly recent one we did. It was a commission from Sight and Sound magazine for their online section. And it's called Haunted Memory, the Cinema of Victor Ariste. And it was particularly meant to correspond with the recent re-release of El Sur by Ariste in London. Now, this is a piece I won't say a lot about it other than to say we're both, you know, huge fans, huge lovers of Ariste's films. And when we started working on this and collecting clips, as we always do, and starting to move the fragments around, we knew that we couldn't use the kind of approach we used for Polanski. It just didn't seem right to have, you know, my booming voice saying, the cinema of Victor Ariste is extremely interesting for the following reasons, right? We had to try another approach. We did want to use voiceover. So basically we tried a much more poetic approach to both voiceover and the editing of the images and sounds from the films. And particularly our inspiration for the mode or the mood of the piece came from rereading some texts by Victor Ariste himself. He's a very gifted writer as well as one of the greatest filmmakers. And he often tells the same story in his texts over and over, which is about a childhood memory of a scene from a film. Not one of his films, some other film that he loves. And from that, everything else follows. Social history, you know, the history of Spain, personal life, family life, often comes from the narration of a childhood memory of a film. So that's the sort of image we worked from. Okay.
Thank you. I could have a million questions about those last two videos, and especially the last one, which, you know, is very straightforwardly my favourite audiovisual essay of all time.
Wow.
And for me, very much moves your work into the arena of the essay film, which I think it's sort of always been in and out of, and kind of, but in a way, this is both an online audiovisual essay and also very much an essay film. And for me, therefore, it raises particular questions around authorship and collaboration, and they're suggested partly by Ariste, who collaborated with his romantic partner in life, and it prompts a question phrased by Godard, who has collaborated with his romantic partners in life, but most recently and importantly with Anne-Marie Mieville, and he kind of pondered this question about the collaboration of the couple and asked about the Straub-Huillet. He kind of wondered, maybe they were on a tandem with him in front and her behind, whereas Godard considered his own collaboration with Mieville as one where they have two bicycles. And I think you have two bicycles. Do you think you have two bicycles? What are the dynamics, especially perhaps with this last video essay, which is so obviously, you know, kind of, your voice does resonate through it, and it feels personal and impersonal. How do you feel about having put it together with Christina?
He has a plane. I go walking.
I mean, the actual sort of dynamics of the collaboration are literally different for every piece. We have no set system of collaboration. The ideas come from anywhere, you know. Sometimes we have both exactly the same idea as we're watching something, you know, without saying it. But then when we compare notes, it's like, oh, man, that scene would be a great audiovisual essay. You know, we have the same thought about it. Other times it's something like a couple of times it's been maybe just a sentence or a paragraph in some old text of mine or of Christina's, and we watch a film and we think, well, how do we have any material on that film, you know? And then we go back to our own written work and there's just a seed of something that wasn't developed in the written form. But we think, oh, maybe we should now take that out and try to expand that out to something. And the actual kind of putting together Christina is the technical genius of editing, but I'm there at all stages, and it basically it's always moving the pieces around, trying different formats, looking at it at every stage, reworking it. So it really is a totally back and forth collaboration. Yeah.
Yes. Have you ever been tempted to do a voiceover, even in Spanish?
I've tried, but yeah. It's very awful, so I'm not going to do it anymore. I tried with a Buñuel piece that I was, trying things, and I put my voiceover. I thought, well, maybe if I, if I speak on a microphone, it's not going to sound so bad. It sounds terrible. I hear myself and I say, why to do that? I mean, if I have this man with that voice, I mean, why don't you take to give you a good use, mm-hmm. So no, I don't see unless I could find a way to totally remade my voice into something that it's not my voice, I don't think I'm going to put voiceover in.
And, I think it simply is, Katie, that I, just in my particular career, I've had to do a lot of things with speaking, like speaking on the radio, which I did for, I did a show on radio for a number of years in Australia, and the audio commentary work I do. And so I've gotten past the point of feeling uneasy about my own voice. I mean, most people, I think, feel that their own voice is terrible, when recorded and played back. But, I've kind of distanced myself from that disgust. Mm. And so, I can kind of do it without getting worried about it.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm very struck by in all of these pieces is, nonetheless, how your voice has changed in this work, but also how much we do hear your voice in this work, Christina. I'd like to invite you now to put up your hands and ask questions or make comments. We have as long as you like. We're over our original 2 hours, but there's nothing stopping us going on for as long as you have things you want to find out about. So does anybody have any questions or comments? Aidan.
Yeah, thanks so much. Wonderful afternoon, Katie, Adriana, and Christina.
Thank you.
This was my first time to ever see an audiovisual essay in the cinema, and it was just wonderful. It was breathtaking. And I'm curious about your response to seeing your work this way. So the cinephilia kind of aspect of it, you're now seeing the work that you've remixed back in its original context in one way, but still your own. So does it change your experience with the work that you're making, seeing it like this, or not?
It changed our experience with the movies, you mean, or with the own work?
With their own work, yeah.
Well, it's always different to watch audiovisual essays in different contexts. And for instance, especially the sound, it's something which is quite tricky to do. And we usually check the sound in several devices. I mean, we check it in the speakers of the computer. We hear it with headphones. We hear it sometimes with the speakers. But now, for instance, today, hearing it here, for me, it was completely different. That's something I don't say it's, I've seen a couple of things in the Polanski thing that I would say, no, I would do that differently, because here you can hear the silence too much, or you cannot. I like a lot to watch it in the big screen. I think that sometimes it's it looks very good. But sometimes also I think you are more aware of little mistakes that when you are watching at home in the TV or in the computer, you are not catching, but I see every little thing. I'm very perfectionist, so but there are some words, for instance, that is very good to watch in the big screen, even if sometimes we try to get the movies in the best quality possible, and sometimes the quality is what it's available, and you cannot. I mean, some of these movies are from DVDs and still the blacks look very pixelated, but you cannot get them in better quality. But I like it, and I think it's good to watch them in different places, because you have to get used to the experience. For me, it's different. It's really different to watch it here than to watch it in my computer.
Yes, I mean, what Christine is talking about is that, like, when we deal with our various editors and publishers, there's this bewildering range of options. Like, you should be able to watch it on your phone. You should be able to watch it on your computer. Few online publishers say you should be able to watch it on a big screen, at Birkbeck, that's another experience again. And in a way, it's the world of film festivals, of special events, of art galleries and so on, which is often not, factored in. Well, so it hasn't been factored in much so far to the kind of work we do. The kind of work that Mark Rappaport does is more like, yes, he wants it for film festivals and everything, as well as the small screen. But it's one effect, to answer your question directly, one effect I have watching these on the big screen is precisely that sense that the image quality is never going to be as perfect as the original film. But I actually think that's poignant in a way. It's like, you know, the critics that we are kind of reach up to these films. You know, we aspire to the greatness of some of these films, like particularly a Rhys's films, and, you know, but we're not going to get all the way there. And I think it's good to be reminded of this sometimes, you know, that we aren't necessarily going to get all the way there, you know. And, but, you know, we try. And so being in this, what we call this sort of hybrid space between, you know, criticism and art, the poignancy of that hybridity sort of comes out when I look at it on a big screen like this.
Yeah. Mandy.
Could I ask a question about Queen Goddard?
Yeah.
Just after it was going on, Laura and I were kind of whispering about it, and I said, you know, how could they have missed it? How could they have missed it? You know, and she was saying, I have no idea, but then she said something parallel to it, but I don't know if she thought this was the answer. She said, Leo is so feminine.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten how beautiful he was. Of course, that sets up a foursome of women rather than three women and a man.
Mm.
But I was, you know, while you were doing this, I was struck by two things. First of all, it's not the obvious film for a straight couple to have made. And secondly, what did you think in your adventure into, was it like Dorothy Arzner? Was it just some sort of bizarre foreclosure of the whole gay thing? Or was it something more complicated?
I think it's very complicated. Like, we took out at a very early stage of Queer Goddard, we were going to have more quotes from film critics.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say, the ones particularly from the 60s are astonishing, mm-hmm. because they invent plot details that are not in the film to explain the character of Elizabeth, the other woman. They say that she's obsessed with Jean-Pierre Léaud's character, right, romantically, or she's obsessed with another man in the film. Sometimes many pieces, and I say particularly from the 60s, don't even mention Elizabeth as a character in the film. Some more recent accounts of the film say it's essentially about, you know, three characters or two characters and don't even mention her. And this is extraordinary, and even in the recent biographies of Goddard, almost nothing is made of that character. And I think it's a complex case of, sometimes it's blindness, like, just, you know, they're not going to see it. Sometimes they don't want to see it, you know. Sometimes they've seen it and then they repress it, you know. I think it's a really complex business. And, you know, some people mention it, like Robin Wood, you know, gay film critic, you know, supreme.
Yeah.
He saw it, but then he says it's not that important in the film, you know. But what the more we went into it, it seems to be an important thing, like a very important thing. But what's interesting is that I don't think Goddard, as filmmaker in 1965, is really... I mean, he hasn't got a queer agenda, a positive queer agenda in 1965. I don't know if he has a positive queer agenda now. But then I think it was a very murky thing for him too, you know. But it's something there that was in the story, the Maupassant story, that obviously totally lodged in his head when he made the film.
Mm.
And there's so many traces of it. So it's murky from Goddard's point of view. It's murky in the film itself. It's easy not to see it in that sense, that it's not explicit, it's not clear. But then the 50 years of criticism... that follow the film. That's another history again.
Because I think at the time Balzac's The Girl with the Golden Eyes was adapted for film by somebody, and I think they did keep the gay implications in some way. So it's not as though those 19th century narratives needed to be completely rewritten. Anyway, thank you.
I have a quick follow-up question about Queer Goddard, which is about the title. You describe it as a provocation. It's described in the piece, the accompanying written text in the online publication of the essay, as a provocation, I think.
Mm.
And
it was widely viewed and it had created a buzz. It's a kind of provocation in the way that Kogonada's wonderful video essay, What is Neorealism, is a provocation. Mm. It's also a provocation in a different sense, but this idea of the generalized statement, and actually the audiovisual essay is about this tiny, small thing. Mm. Did you get a response from that one? And what about the response to your work in general? Mm. Because, of course, it's online. Mm. Is there any dialogue between you and your audience beyond the ones that happen in cinemas? Mm.
We actually have not had any specific response to it. I mean, it's been viewed a lot.
We've got some Facebook complaints about the title. But
we had some questions, on Facebook about, isn't this a bit broad, and what are you saying? He's queer, or are you saying his work is queer? It has a queer politics, but it was more like, an attempt to sort of to look at queerness in Gora,
Well, and there's also people who say it's not convinced by the argument, people, which I think it's interesting. You cannot be convinced at all. I mean, for some people, they say, okay, I see that there's like a disinterest of her in the boyfriend, but they don't see so clear that there's an interest between the two friends, which I really see in the movie. I think in many, and the way we constructed the audiovisual essay was a little bit like this. We began a little bit between the relationship between her and Jean-Pierre Law, and then we moved a little bit into the relationship with her girlfriend. But still, there's people which sees very clearly that there's like that she's not comfortable with him, but they don't see so clearly that there may be something else going on with the friend. That happens or doesn't happen, but that it's there. I mean, I think it's fleeting, but I think it's there. Mm. Mm. And I think it's there in a lot of scenes and in a lot of gestures, in a lot of little moments in the movie.
Mm. And just on the actual title of the piece, I remember there was a moment where, we had more bland and longer titles, another way of looking at masculine, feminine, or something, and then it was just like, oh, fuck it, Queer Gora, let's just call it Queer Gora and, throw that out there.
Yeah, that's very good. Okay, Joanna.
I have a question about how doing this work has created any sort of insights for you into the role of the editor.
Oh, like massive, as in the role of the editors of these films or films generally?
Generally,
Oh, God.
I mean, actually, we defend that, that when you write a text, you are using literature as your medium. When you do audiovisual essays, you are using editing. Editing is really the creative. I mean, it's everything for us in an audiovisual, because, this is something. Some people say, oh, you are, giving it too much importance. What about the voiceover? What about the text that you write for the audiovisual essay? But for me, this is secondary. I mean, for me, the discourse of an audiovisual essay, when you are doing it, it's all in editing. So it's, it's like God. Editing, it's God. And you can do so many things, and you can learn so much about editing, really, doing these pieces, which, it's amazing. But I mean, if you ask me, how do you work in an audiovisual essay, it's the main thing you do, it's editing. Mm. It's not to write a voiceover, it's not to put together some fragments of films. It's actually using editing in a creative way, in a way that you can say something by the act of using editing, whatever, to put two images together, to put a sound and an image together, to construct the whole structure of the piece. So it's very important, and it's something that, since we began, I think we've learned really a lot.
And we appreciate editing, in films, in television, in everything, better. I mean, we actually see it, we hear it better than we originally did. I mean, I often tell the tale of my old friend in Australia, Philip Brophy, who's an artist and a filmmaker as well as a great critic, and he once, gave a talk on a panel like this, and he was just sort of fed up with all of the abstract theoretical talk, and he just said, look, if you've never tried to edit one image with another image, and if you've never tried to put that with a sound, you don't understand anything. You don't understand anything. And you'll learn a lot if you try it. And, and this is exactly the experience that I've had, is to, to actually work with anything and to see, when two things don't go together, when an image and a sound are not working together, which leads you to experiment and explore and, try other options.
Because one thing is the idea you begin with, but later when sometimes you try to do it and it simply doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
And you can move it and it doesn't work. And
Can I read you one thing that came after the way you quoted the Philip Brophy statement there in one of your brilliant pieces on all of this work? And this is from the piece The One and the Many. And for me, it was a brilliant piece on editing, having researched that as a kind of area of film studies as well. Every element we pluck out has many simultaneous levels and multiple channels or tracks. When we confront any two elements, we are confronting two heterogeneous, internally multiple blocks. Montage means, and every editor knows this intuitively, finding which channels or tracks across these two pieces can be connected in some way, creating a through line, a passage or movement. Mm. And from there you make an argument about how scholarly arguments or critical arguments can be carried in that through line, which is sometimes narrative and sometimes associative. Anyway, I got it in, but would you like to ask?
Well, yeah. I just wanted to ask about what constraints do you use when you're editing, so that what would you not do? So I'm thinking about changing the time, like stretching time, to draw attention to something. So do you have things that you don't do to manipulate the material that you're using?
It depends very much on each project. I don't have like one thing that I say I would never do that with that movie, because you can. I mean, there are things that I don't do because I don't know how to do them. That's like the big constraint. But actually, no, because there's people that's. I mean, there's people that has it, that says I would never do to a movie. You know, I don't know. I would never change the frame of a movie. I would never crop the frame of a movie. I say, you know, it depends on what you want. Because, for instance, it's this. If I want at some point to, you know, to focus the attention, and for me it's useful to slow down. I don't like a lot the slow motion I don't like it aesthetically a lot. But if it is useful at some point, I may use it. Okay. What I don't like is audiovisual essays that have a slow motion just from the start till the end. Yeah. You know? But in itself, it's not something that I say I would never use. I mean, I can use it if I think it's useful, and if you use it and it works. Because sometimes, again, it's this: you come with an idea. You can come with the idea of, for instance, in Queer Godard, there are a lot of scenes that are actually, and we try. I mean, what we try is that you, in some places, you don't notice the editing. But for instance, there's this scene where the two girls are going to sleep together, and one of the friend is trying to put Paul in the room with the other one, and the other one says no, and then Paul enters to the room. That scene is pretty long, so we cut a bit of that scene because they close the light, because we didn't need that part. So he closes the light, goes to the bed. So we cut, I don't know, 30 seconds or something, but we try that this is not visible. It's like if the scene was like this. There's people that would tell you, no, you are changing a scene from the original context. You shouldn't do that. For us, this is not a problem. It depends on what you really want to use of that scene, what's the point that you want to make. And in this case, for instance, to keep the whole scene was too long, was simply too long, and there was part of the scene which was adding nothing to our point, so we prefer to cut this if you can cut it and it looks okay.
And can I just follow up with the rights? So the rights for the films that you use, do you clear them
That's the legal disclaimer of fair use and of educational use, is the study purposes only.
It makes me feel a bit uncomfortable. it's a very interesting meeting.
Well, usually these pieces, we put them on Vimeo or on YouTube. I don't like YouTube very much because there's like a lot of claims about copyright, usually from the music, using music. There are cases of people, especially using things that are very, very commercial, that have been taken down for copyright problems.
Mm. But let me just add here, this is a happy note for us, is that, you know, sometimes, of course, we've had a moment of anxiety thinking, oh, God, what if Victor Arise hates our guts for cutting his films up, you know, into our own thing? And we've had two really good experiences, where one of them was when we worked with a film by Philippe Gondrieu, the French director, and we took shots of his film and intercut it with The Night of the Hunter by Charles Laughton. And when we screened that in Barcelona, you know, he was there watching it, and we thought, oh, shit, you know? is he going to hate us for this? And he kind of came out very thoughtful, and he goes, I think I'll re-edit my film now. and the other, you know, great thing we got was we made a long piece about Brian De Palma. you know, and now we're talking Hollywood, right? We're talking about the American commercial system. But we got an email from Brian De Palma saying, I really am grateful for your video essay. You know, he loved it. And he took it as a fan critic act of appreciation of his work. So he didn't sue us. It was really good.
It's great when you get the appreciation, but what if students, for example, start using and quoting small sections from your video essay? How do you feel about that? And secondly, if you're really going into this world of editing, are you now going to make a film?
Mm. Well, what about the first one? If one of our pieces were used in another, like a student's piece?
They are. I think you have to take it. I would like to be recognized, you know, at the end, as, you know?
At least some acknowledgement.
Acknowledgement, that's it, acknowledgement. But for me, it's okay. I mean, for me, it's okay. It's not a problem. As far as it's acknowledged, I mean, then you have the case of Godard, which quotes a lot and doesn't acknowledge nothing, you know, because he says, well, who cares, you know, you only have
anti-copyright, that's the thing he writes, yeah.
But, you know, I like the acknowledgement because, you know, there's somebody there who has made the thing, and I think it needs to be acknowledged. And the second question was about...
Well, are you going to... You know, direct, make a film, go on location, make a film.
I'm not interested in, I could not work with a team, I think. But actually, really, what I'm most interested about the whole process of filmmaking, it's editing. It's the thing that I'm most interested about. And if somebody gives me material and gives me freedom, I would edit it happily. But to shoot, it's something I'm not super interested about, and especially I think if I was doing a very personal project alone, I could do it, but I don't think I could work with more than him. It's already sometimes.
I mean, we do have some dreams, not firm plans yet, but some dreams more along the lines of what Katie was suggesting, a sort of a longer essay film that builds on, you know, some of the type of things we do in audiovisual essays. So it would be most like the Arise piece that we ended with today. But we're not exactly sure sort of what that would be yet. But, yeah.
I mean, it's good for me, as I said before, for me very much this is a work of film criticism. So I really need the other film. I mean, it's a relation with other films, with films that already pre-exist. It's not that I want to create something from scratch. The pleasure of doing all this, it's that you establish a relation with something that it's already there, and you give a response to that film or an idea about that film, but it's very much about the films. So it's not that I really want to make my film, it's that I really love to, you know, to interact with other films.
There was a question up there.
It's a little bit related, I suppose, to the second part of that last lady's question. I suppose the question is for all three of you as well, I'm kind of interested in what happens when the viewer doesn't know the film that's being studied. It's happened like a few times to me today. Particularly when, or given that we're in a cinema, and also that, also particularly when there's no, like, voiceover or in titles, it seems to be some kind of quality that exists that I'm not quite sure how to understand, but obviously for you guys it's impossible for you to sort of know what that would be like, given that you're studying these films as well as making them, but it was just something that I noticed.
So what's your question exactly?
If you don't know the films, I mean, he don't know some of the films we were using. I always say, for me as a film critic, you know, I always, when I watch audiovisual essays, usually I prefer to have seen the films myself and to know the films, and I think you get more if you have seen the films. But still, I think that even if you haven't seen the films, if you are not super anxious about what am I understanding or not, you still can enjoy, so maybe not all, but some audiovisual essays, just trying to see what this person is doing with these materials, even if you don't know the origin of these materials and what these materials in their original context mean. But what I would say is that any audiovisual essay has like levels, you know? And there are things that you are not going to pick sometimes, if, even if you have seen the movie. And you, I'm going to put you an example. Queer Godard, for instance. Okay, this is the film Masculine Feminine. Of course, we watched it a lot of times to do the audiovisual essay. I think that if you have seen the film maybe one or two times, there are many things of the audiovisual essay that you may not be completely picking. Of course, there are even more things if you have not seen the film. But still, I think that our main point, which is we are, that there's a relationship between these two women, or a hint of a relationship between these two women, I think you still can get this point. Of course, the difference is that you now are watching only the fragments in which this happens, and you are not watching the whole movie. So I would say in that case, a spectator who has not seen the whole movie would even be, it would be easier for him to agree with our point than someone that has seen the movie maybe and has forgotten it. Another thing, for instance, one of the moments in the last part, in the last section of the audiovisual essay, one of the things that we do is, and this is so, for somebody I think that knows the movie pretty well, there are two scenes that happen in a bathroom, okay? One, it's a scene where they are in a cinema and Jean-Pierre Lotte goes to the bathroom and sees these two guys kissing. And the other, it's a scene that happens in the house, where he's going to the kitchen or something, and through a window, he hears the two girls in the bathroom, naked, laughing, blah, blah. One thing that we did there, and that I think only somebody that is very familiarized with the movie could really pick, it's to invert the order of these two scenes. Because we put the scene of the bathroom of the two guys first, and we later put the scene that in the movie comes first, which is when he sees the two girls. And for us, this is also a way, I mean, because our piece, it's all about this idea of recognition and of erasing and of repressing. For us, this was a way to say, she already, what he's seeing later, which is these two men kissing in the toilet, it's in a way telling him or putting in the surface what he has seen before but has not acknowledged, that it's that these two, his girlfriend and the other girl, are in the bathroom together laughing and who knows what else. But this is something that we don't expect that every viewer understands, because if you have not seen the movie, if you don't know the order of these scenes in the original movie, you may not be picking this thing. But as I say, I mean, we work in several levels in an audiovisual essay, and I think they are still can be enjoyable in some level, even if you don't know and you don't understand everything that we've made, if you have not seen the movies. Mm. And also, I think that sometimes it's a good incentive for people that has not seen the movies, and maybe they see the audiovisual essay and they get curious about the films and they want to watch the movies. Mm. So everybody's welcome to watch them.
And in a way, that's why online publishers are so in favour of this material. And in a way, that raises ethical questions when audiovisual essays are being commissioned kind of as publicity material for the film that they're also trying to sell. And what's the role of critical distance and scholarly distance in that kind of context? So there's all sorts of ethical swirling around this material. Mm. But to just briefly reply to your question about... because I think it is really interesting, because there are so many bits of films circulating online, films that we could never possibly see the entirety of. So it's the kind of new libidinal economy of audiovisual material in our world. And one of the ways some of us are dealing with that is to actually make video essays about those weird feelings we find when we see a fragment from a film that we've never seen before and that we really are compelled by. And I made a video just on that clip without gasp, watching the whole film, and I still haven't. But the kind of recycling and reuse, I think, can be put to all sorts of different purposes.
I mean, that brings up an interesting idea about teaching film material, because I used to teach cinematography for a long time, and I always taught with extracts, comparing one thing and another thing as ways of thinking about mise-en-scène or what have you. But generally, my film critic and film theorist friends would be trying to show a whole film and then analysing a sequence after, and so it's a different... So it does lend itself to different parts of, you know, perhaps not just narrative and characters and plot, but yeah. other things.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of our guiding principles that we always try to, you know, deal. I mean, really our main driving interest is sort of form and style, not simply narrative and character. And I mean, we have a bit of a complaint about audiovisual essays that are purely about sort of annotating the experiences of characters. This man is lonely, you know, this woman is sad. You know, sometimes you get audiovisual essays that are simply like embroidering the emotional states of characters, you know. And, you know, we're always trying to do something a little more general as a field of exploration, whether it's a genre or it's a cultural question like motherhood in Cronenberg and Hitchcock, or, you know, it's never just these characters in this story, and everything to do with style, you know, mise-en-scene, editing, of course, montage, that's really one of the main things, the colour, you know, that is the things that really drive often the decisions, the editing decisions we make.
Any other questions? Okay, at the back.
I have a question. How do you write the scripts of the estate? I mean, you first write the estate, and then you figure out how to put in images? Or
absolutely not, Antala. No, absolutely not. It's almost always, I mean, we talk at the start, you know, it's like we've got an idea. And then the next part of the process is often watching, re-watching the film, taking notes. And from that stage, Christina starts to isolate segments of the film, like to, in a way, to reduce the film down to the parts that we think we'll use.
And then which is always too much.
Yeah, always too much at the start.
But see, it's still a reduction because, you know, for instance, the Polanski audiovisual essay, we're using 8 movies. That his movies are long, let me tell you, they are all more than 2 hours, which means already 16 hours of material. So in order to begin, because if we began with the 16 hours of material there, I think I would go crazy or something. So the first thing is to try to take off what we are sure we are not going to use, because it's not part of our approach, it's not part of our idea. And we may reduce the material, I don't know, to one-third, one-fourth maybe, which is still too much always, but it's already, you know, a way to begin, to say, okay, now we use what we have here. Sometimes we always have to go back and we realize we forgot something. But that's like the first thing, to reduce a bit what you are going to use, because otherwise it's like too much and it's too difficult to edit with so much material. You can... Yeah.
And then...
You're filtering the film.
Yeah, we filter the film, and at that point of sort of having reduced the film, then there might be an element of writing, as in literally I might, you know, or we might write some sentences, but they're like disembodied sentences, and they might be voiceover or an intertitle, right? But they're not necessarily in the order that they'll end up in the final thing, and we never have a script. And in fact, I would say the moments where it's been frustrating for us is if we've thought it out too much at the start, you know, if we once or twice, you know, we've thought, well, we have to get this finished, you know, quick, let's map out what we're going to do, so we'll have this sentence of voiceover with this shot from the movie, blah blah blah, and that's not as exciting for us because we're not discovering anything then, right? So it's purely in the editing, and then we're rewriting, we're re-recording, because we do all this at home, right? We're not going into a recording studio, you know, we've just got a microphone in the laptop and we're doing the voiceover at home. We do all the editing on the laptop computer. So it's purely domestic, artisanal production, right? Which means we can do it and redo it and, you know, and just keep moving the pieces around until we're happy that it's found a form. And often even the start and end is something we don't necessarily exactly know where the piece will start and end. We have to find the best way to start, the best way to end. And sometimes the endings, you know, are almost a surprise to us. You know, it's just like with Polanski, the Polanski piece, to sort of end with, you know, the crowds of people mocking him. No, that was sort of, that came purely through editing. We didn't have an idea that this was the conclusion of our thought, you know, about Polanski, but it arose as the best place to end.
And I was going to say...
I just wanted to respond to that, because I understand that you can't, with the Polanski piece, you can't put all of the films in, but I was waiting for
Which one?
Chinatown.
Yes.
Well, that was one that we sort of...
Chinatown, it's like... Yeah.
Well, partly it was like we think that's one of those ones that's been kind of overdone, you know, kind of worked to death. And we thought, we actually didn't have anything new to say. I mean, there were moments where, yeah, we could have put in, you know, slicing the nose and, you know, a thousand things that everybody knows in Chinatown. And we thought, why do it, you know? So it was like a sort of a very underground provocation to leave it out, you know.
Yeah.
It was part of the retrospective in Melbourne. It's coming up in that retrospective. But we thought, you know, for us it was more interesting to look at some other films that aren't talked about so much with Polanski, like The Ghost Rider, like Bitter Moon, like Frantic.
Yeah, that seems to be quite a theme of audiovisual essays. I know, Catherine, I saw your film here, I think, which was the slow motion with Simone Signoret.
Yes, yeah, there was the clip I was talking about, was from Le Jour et l'Heure,
Clément.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know the film, but it didn't matter. I found watching some of your pieces that, because you're juxtaposing films that are sort of creating new meanings,
yeah,
I did feel at a bit of a disadvantage when I didn't know the film. Maybe because of the whole idea of intertextuality and knowing the whole film and the story of it. But I enjoyed them anyway. They feel a bit like they are cinephilia pieces for cinephiles.
Yes, yeah. And Adrian and Christine have a wonderful turn of phrase to describe both something that often coexists in their work, and perhaps the Godard piece would be a place where it coexists in the work, but also sometimes is held in opposition across a body of work, and that the audiovisual essay is particularly good at tender admiration and trenchant critique. And so I think this idea of the tender admiration, the concernful dealings with the film, way of handling the film that is informed by, even if you don't love it at the beginning, maybe The Girl in the Motorcycle specifically, the handling and the tender admiration will develop through that process, concernful dealing. Well, let us end there. So many thanks to you for your great questions, and thank you especially to Adrian and Christina for their generosity and for the excellence of their work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you to Matthew and Michael and Laura Agumi for all of their brilliant organisation of this event.
Thank you.